January 1966, 10 artists from New York and 30 engineers from Bell Telephone Laboratories began a collaboration that resulted in a series of dance, music, and theater works. They all incorporated the new technology. 9 evenings of theater and engineering took place in October 1966 at the 69th Regiment Armory in New York. The performances were recorded and filmed both in color and in black and white. While this material can of course not represent the artist's work in full, it has now been assembled by Barbara Schulz into 10 films that document each artist's work. 9 evenings came about through the generosity of the artists, the engineers, and our many friends. But above all, it was Robert Rauschenberg's commitment to the collaboration that provided the spirit and the energy that made it all happen.
Listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and tonight we'll focus on John Cage's variations works with a special look and listen to his Variation 7. Variation 7 was first staged as the second in a series of 10 planned performance-themed pieces that comprised EAT's 9 Evenings, Theater and Engineering performance series that was given October 13 to 23, 1966, at the 69th Regiment Armory in New York City. Other artists that contributed works across the series included Lucinda Childs, Oyvind Fallstrom, Alex Hay, Deborah Hay, Steve Paxton, Yvonne Rayner, Robert Rauschenberg, David Tudor, and Robert Whitman. John Cage's Variation 7 is essentially a plan for finding an arrangement of a specific electroacoustic system in which performers are allowed to act in a free and unscripted manner, where Variation 6 from the same year was a tool for creating a sound system. Here we have a tool for creating a musical score. Or, as James Pritchett once put it, the sound system was designed with the limitation that only sounds that arose during the performance were to be used. In other words, the performers would not make any actions to generate sounds deliberately, but rather would use technological means to discover sounds in the air. The work was set up as a collaboration between and among artists and engineers. In it, one could hear amplified sounds of the heart, lungs, brain, and other body parts, as well as Geiger counters, radios, televisions, telephones, etc. The performance engineer was Cecil Coker, and grateful acknowledgement was made by Cage for the cooperation of the Merce Cunningham Dance Foundation, Lu Chow's Restaurant, the ASPCA, the New York Times, the City of New York, Terry Riley, Robert Wood, Richard Hennessy, and Ruben Gorowitz. In the souvenir program provided at the first performance, Cage wrote the following statement. "My project is simple to describe. It is a piece of music, Variation 7, indeterminate in form and detail, making use of the sound system which has been devised collectively for this festival, further making use of modulation means organized by David Tudor, using as sound sources only those sounds which are in the air at the moment of performance, picked up via the communication bands, telephone lines, microphones together with, instead of musical instruments, a variety of household appliances and frequency generators. The technical problems involved in any single project tend to reduce the impact of the original idea, but in being solved, they produce a situation different than anyone could have pre-imagined." Julie Martin, longtime wife to and now widow of Billy Cluver, is the current director of Experiments in Art and Technology, or EAT, the nonprofit organization co-founded in 1966 in New York by artists Robert Rauschenberg and Robert Whitman, and engineers Billy Cluver and Fred Waldhauer, to encourage and facilitate collaborations between artists and engineers. Martin joined the EAT staff in 1967 and worked closely with Cluver on EAT projects over the years up until the time of his death in 2004. With Cluver and art historian Barbara Rose, she co-edited the book Pavilion, published by E.P. Dutton in 1972, that documents the Pepsi Pavilion, which was designed and built by EAT for Expo 70 in Osaka. She collaborated with Cluver on numerous articles on art and technology, including a marvelous piece entitled Working with Rauschenberg for the exhibition catalog published on the occasion of Rauschenberg's 1997 retrospective at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. Martin is also co-executive producer of a series of films begun in 1995 that document the artist performances presented at Nine Evenings. In recent years, Martin has acted as coordinating producer for theater works and video cell phone performances by Robert Whitman, one of the Nine Evenings artists. In 2017 and 2018, she was production manager for a number of performances by Sylvia Palacios Whitman in the United States and Europe. She is currently working with Danish sound artist Jacob Kierkegaard on a multi-part audio documentary of the history of EAT using interviews held in the EAT archives. Billy Cluver was an electrical engineer at Bell Telephone Laboratories. He was born in Monaco in 1927 and died in New Jersey, where he and Julie Martin long lived, in 2004. Julie Martin was born in Nashville, and since Cluver's death has almost single-handedly carried the EAT torch. She graduated from Radcliffe College with a degree in philosophy and from Columbia University with a master's degree in Russian studies. Julie and I have often spoken about Billy Cluver and the formation of EAT, and also much about three in particular of Cage's works from his Variations series, Variations 5, 6, and 7, all from 1965-66, each making extensive use of electronics and each made possible through Cage's collaboration with Cluver. Significantly, both Variations 5 and Variations 7 have a priori scores, which is to say scores that were created after the works were performed, hence were both reports of the performance as well as guides for future performances. Cage created 8 works in his Variation series, although the first 4, Variations 1, 2, 3, and 4, which date from 1958 to 1963, all having indeterminate structures, durations, and instrumentations, do not lead naturally to the technologically rich Variations 5, 6, and 7. Variations 8, the most anomalous of the lot, was conceived in 1972, but not actualized until 1978. And it derived from what sounds a lot like a miscommunication between the presenters and Cage as to what was expected from him. Cage described its essence initially as machines themselves without anything given to them, for example, tape machines without tapes. It was first performed by the ensemble Musica Negativa, founded in 1969 by Heinz Klaus Metzger and Rainer Rien, and presented in Cologne on one of the ensemble's stops with a touring exhibition that comprised artworks and scores by John Cage. Variations 8 exist today in a published score that consists solely of a reproduction of a simple poster created for Metzger and Rien that begins, "No music, no recordings." Incidentally, in the 1980s, Metzger and Rien would become chief dramatic advisors to the Frankfurt Opera under Gary Bertini. During their tenure, the Frankfurt Opera would commission and premiere John Cage's only full-scale opera, Europas 1 and 2. Returning to Variations 5 from 1965, this is a work scored for any number of musicians and at least 13 electronically amplified sound sources and 2 systems that allowed the movement of the dancers to affect the sound. The collaborative team that produced this work was large. Choreography by Merce Cunningham, sound system by David Tudor, electronic percussion devices by Robert Moog, photoelectric devices by Billy Kluger and colleagues at Bell Laboratories, televised image distortions by Namjoon Paik, film by Stan Vanderbeek, mixer by Max Matthews, tape recordings by John Cage, lighting by Beverly Emmons, and shortwave receivers, along with their special placement by Kluver and Frederick Lieberman. Billy Kluver was key not only to Variations 5, which was first performed by the Merce Cunningham Dance Company at New York's Lincoln Center on July 23, 1965, but to both Variation 6 and Variation 7. We began tonight's program with a brief excerpt from Variation 7 with words by Kluver, which we'll hear again and then continue on. This rich documentation of Variation 7 is the work of Julie Martin and her collaborator, the Swedish journalist and independent movie and documentary director, Barbara Schultz Lindestam, and released by Experiments in Art and Technology in 2008 on a Marvelous Art Picks DVD. This DVD, still readily available, documents the only complete performance of Variation 7 and also presents a stereo audio recording of the full 85 minutes of the 1966 performance. The audience is nicely captured in this DVD, including John Cage's mother, Lucretia, who wanders about with a look of utter amazement or confusion on her face, or maybe both. You just can't tell. Voices you'll hear describing the processes and proceedings include not only Kluver and Cage, but also Anthony Nazo, David Behrman, Merce Cunningham, David Tudor, Lowell Cross, Terry Riley, and others. Other DVDs, by the way, available from the In Progress 9 Evenings series include Open Score by Robert Rauschenberg from 2007, and Bandoneon, a Combine by David Tudor from 2010. Now back to Variation 7. Enjoy.
January 1966, 10 artists from New York and 30 engineers from Bell Telephone Laboratories began a collaboration that resulted in a series of dance, music, and theater works. They all incorporated the new technology. 9 evenings of theater and engineering took place in October 1966 at the 69th Regiment Armory in New York. The performances were recorded and filmed both in color and in black and white. While this material can of course not represent the artist's work in full, it has now been assembled by Barbara Schulz into 10 films that document each artist's work. 9 evenings came about through the generosity of the artists, the engineers, and our many friends. But above all, it was Robert Rauschenberg's commitment to the collaboration that provided the spirit and the energy that made it all happen.
Thank you. interesting thing about that piece is that it didn't use any magnetic tape. That is to say, no recorded sounds were part of it. All the sounds were, so to speak, in the air or in oscillators that were producing sounds at the instant that they're being heard by the performers and by the audience. And that is its principal interest.
In order to accommodate John's performance, we found quickly that the control room, which we had built with great pain, was too small. So we had to build a special platform in front of the control room where we set up tables about 4 by 30 feet. On the tables, John had put household equipment such as juicers, fans, blenders, and radios. On these were placed contact microphones. These were triggered on off by photocells placed on the table. The photocells were activated by John and his collaborators as they walked around the platform back and forth and broke the light beam that hit the photocells, distributing the sounds from the contact microphones around the armory. The light that hit the photocells was strong enough to give very beautiful shadows.
Variation 7. I think it must have been the furthest out he went in terms of giving up control, because there was really no specification of what should happen as time passed. And so, I remember doing the performance as almost kind of like a dream, that there was a big pool of sound, and we were kind of, I remember it kind of as though I were a bartender. It felt like a bar, and we were kind of going up and down, serving drinks to the audience. I think John Cage had a lot of courage because he clearly was not trying to make something that would be quote-unquote successful. I mean, he practiced what he preached, and he believed in giving up control and accepting sounds from the world, and that's what it was.
At the time of the Armory show in 1966, we acquired 10 telephone lines, which I got from the Bell Telephone Company, to install in the Armory. On the telephones themselves, we had magnetic pickups on the receivers so that the sounds could be picked up and processed for redistribution in the armory. The telephones went to different parts of the city, like Merce Cunningham's studio.
Yes, well, there was, it was a quite, not this big, but quite large space, and very high. And it had windows onto Third Avenue, so of course there was traffic sounds. And there was also in the studio room, this was a very big room, but still off in the corner, which was sort of covered with screens, was a kitchen, a sink, and a refrigerator, and a stove. And they worked moderately well. And the sink, there was something wrong with it, I think, as I don't remember it now, it's a long time ago, but it dripped a lot some way, and I think that was one of the sounds that John probably used. The traffic you would get anyway, because the minute you put up a microphone there, that's what you heard. And also the room reverberated in a very interesting way. It was old an old New York building. It must have been 1900, and very high, so the sound sort of ran around it.
One of the telephones ended up in the kitchen of Lee Chow's, which was then a very popular restaurant on 14th Street, where everybody went and got a very good and substantial meal. We had one where the telephone could be hung over a street, an aviary, and we had one at the sanitation department. Another of the open telephone lines ended up in Terry Riley's turtle tank. He was a proud owner of turtles which swam around in a tank. And this was precisely the sort of thing that John would be fascinated by.
I remember visiting one day at the Armory when they were setting up, and I specifically came down to show him this piece of mine in C, which then was very new. I had just composed it a few years before, but it hadn't been recorded yet. And I wanted to show it to him, and he was, you know, and we talked about it, and he was kind of tickled to see it, and he was saying, well, it's so great, all the interesting things that young musicians are doing now. And then, quite possibly, we talked about this piece and the fact that I did have some things around my house that he might want to use as a sound source. Actually, I got interested in turtles because of Lamont Young was raising turtles. And I used to go over and help him bathe and take care of his. Then we decided we wanted to have some too at our place.
John wanted to pick up the sound of the motor running to clean the water or circulate the water inside the tank.
Yeah, we had the turtles set up with the motor, and then we brought the phone over to the right where the motor was, and so it could broadcast.
In his inimitable curiosity, John wanted the New York Times press room as a sound. That is, when it was running, and it happened to be the time, the presses happened to be the time when the performance went on. So one of the telephone lines ended up at the Times presses. The sounds from the radios on the platform were from broadcast bands that one normally doesn't hear in the United States. We tried to find radios that could get the long wave band and the short wave band, and the FM band, of course, which was very unused in those days. This was the radio that we used in the Nine Evenings. I bought probably 8 or 10 of them. What was interesting about this particular radio, it was built right in the transition period, when one had transistorized radios, and it had access to all the bands.
1966, I was learning electronics, and it was directly applicable to that. I was very interested in the relationship between sound and light. I worked also with photocells at that time, or a little later, and I was, you know, that was the first time in history where electronics were inexpensive, small, lightweight, because the transistor was rather new then.
David had brought from Stony Point a large horn loudspeaker he called George. One of my tasks on October 15th was to get George operational so that John could have more audio. We installed George on a stand on the armory floor. While fooling around with George, the amplifier, and the voltage-controlled generators, I began to make sounds like air raid sirens. John rushed over and exclaimed, "Oh, isn't that marvelous? It sounds like war. Let's open with that tonight." In the Nine Evenings program, where the flow chart schematic diagram of John's piece is set forth, there is a rectangle in this flow chart that says David's Own. This meant David Tudor's own collection of gadgets, and many of which he would connect up in various nonlinear feedback modes so that he could make oscillation sounds that may have sounded out of control, but that is exactly what David wanted.
The armory was known for its long echo, which we measured up to 6 seconds, and which in fact, before we moved in, we knew about, and which somehow horrified us. When David and John discovered it, they realized that they had another dimension to play with. They made use of it, rather than fighting the armory, which would have been a disaster or an impossibility. They were, in fact, like inside a big organ pipe or something where you could hear the resonant frequencies of the sound.
It was a large space, but it also, to some extent, took all the harsh edges off of any sound they might have produced. And so it was a rather pleasant sounding thing, especially the cage piece where he really wanted to do all, you know, was doing all these noise-like sounds. I mean, they were just so, just filtered by the reverb and everything, just everything was just so lovely and everything. Once it got going, it would really go, but everything was, all of the gestures were very large and slow just because of the large decay time.
I remember that I was wired up for brainwaves. That was one thing I did. And the brainwave amplification, of course, came from Alvin Lucier. And John gave credit to Alvin. But I mean, I think technologically, that was probably the most sophisticated part of the experiments in art and technology, which was to use high tech in a way that hadn't been done before. I think that was probably the most interesting side of it in John's piece.
Well, Billy Clover got me into it very early in the game, I guess. I was in the research division trying to make computers talk at a time when that was very difficult. But earlier in the game, I had been doing most of that by wired electronics, not by programmed computer. And right now, I can't think how I would have done it.
What about the
patch board? The patch board was something that came late in the game.
Yeah.
We got over there and suddenly realized we don't have anything like that.
Exactly.
Well, it was a way of getting any sound we had on the array of inputs to any speaker we had on the array of outputs. You put your finger on the source and ran over to the column for the destination and pushed a plug in or pushed a plug with a potentiometer in.
The size of the armory was huge, and somehow the sound had to be transmitted from the control console or John Cage's platform up to the speakers. So we needed a lot of wiring for the sound. But we also had to put on connectors in both ends, of course. This turned out to be a last-minute affair, and everybody had to help to crimp on connectors, or mini-plugs, as we call them. So everybody got mobilized, including John Cage.
I don't remember the piece of equipment exactly now, but I remember the incident that things were going for about 30 minutes, and I realized that something just wasn't working at all. And I don't remember if I sent John a note or if I went over to the side and motioned him over to me and told him that what needed to be done to fix it. And he said, well, come on, get up on the stage. You're part of the performance. So right in the middle of all of that, I came on and did the work and then got out of the way. But the fact was that it didn't occur to me that that was the way things operated.
They had clamped or placed at the edge of the platform what would be like footlights. And in the Cage piece, all the equipment was arrayed in the front on tables right across the front, and all the wires and everything was going down the front. And then all these lights were essentially coming up like footlights under the table and stuff like that. And I was essentially kind of a flunky during the piece, and I would go around and move things around and get things and adjust things. And I would occasionally step down from the platform to walk around the front. And at one point, I stepped down, and Cage was, as he always was intent on whatever he was doing. And he was sitting there, and I can't, I say this, but I can't exactly remember, but probably with a cigarette holder in his mouth and cigarette in it, and just clenching on that and turning a knob or just tuning in a sound or really going in for it. And his legs are about this far away from these 1,000-watt lamps. And I'm standing out, I'm on the floor, so I'm down a little bit, and I'm walking by. And I go by there, and his pants are smoldering. And I look up, and I say, John, and he's going like this. I say, John, your pants are on fire. And he looks down, and he says, isn't that marvelous? And he just keeps going.
The audience was sitting very far from John, whose platform was built on one of the short sides of the armory. On the first performance, one person left his seat and walked across the armory floor to see what John was doing. He was immediately followed by other spectators.
Fantastic sound is coming from nowhere, everywhere. So we were just walking around. Audience, naturally, audience started taking a walk in there. It was in the movie, no? Nobody asked them to go take a walk, but naturally people stood up and they start kind of wandering around.
Well, John liked this idea very much, and the next performance, we encouraged the audience to leave their seats and come down and listen to him. Well, a lot of the audience then ended up on the floor, lying on the floor of the armory, and watching the light play in the ceiling and listening to the music.
Sound was a vast sound. In the bus, 1969, the armory is a very big space and nothing, and just sound from everywhere, like Niagara Falls of sound. I think that was by far the best piece of John, best performance of John Cage, and maybe best performance of all electronic music. So David chose John Cage, a fantastic team, but I think this is the best they ever produced.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.